Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome to a special on-location episode of the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Only two episodes this week for you. I hope you were able to catch my previous episode on the socialist war against work, but they haven't won their war against me trying to write my book, Why Catholics Can't Be Socialists. That's been sent off, and hopefully we'll have it available for purchase here in early spring. But for now that the book is off my plate, I am engaged in another project right now. I am working with other members of the Catholic Answers staff to create our casa. That is not our house. It's not our Spanish seaside getaway. CASA stands for Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, the CASA. So we've already filmed one of those courses, and I'm up here live in Oceanside, California, with members of the Catholic Answers team filming my course, Moral Apologetics. And so before I get into that, I'm going to share with you some excerpts of the course that we taped today. I think you guys are really going to like them. I want to give a big shout out to our supporters at TrenthornPodcast.com. You guys have been awesome. Thank you so much for your support. We're growing, reaching more people, and you're making it possible for me to bring in more guests to have our dialogue episodes. So next week, I am planning to have a dialogue with the atheist John Loftus on whether it's rational to believe in miracles. Pray that that all goes well, and also pray the dialogue will happen. I am assuming next Monday I have jury duty, and I am assuming as an opinionated Catholic who studies morality all the time, they don't want me to be on a jury. So I'm hoping they won't take me. Otherwise, if they do, I have to cancel the interview. So Pray that justice is done. So that'll be next week, my interview with John Loftus. Got other great people coming on the show. In October, I'm going to have Tim Gordon. You might know him and his work with Taylor Marshall. Tim is going to come on the show. We're going to talk about things that we disagree about, like the death penalty, feminism, and Catholic teaching on those subjects. I think it's going to be a ton of fun. You want to keep an eye on that in October. But it's your support at TrenthornPodcast.com that makes it possible for me to have on guests like John Loftus or Tim Gordon and produce these high-quality shows to show to many other people. So be sure to check that out, TrenthornPodcast.com. Get access to bonus content. New content is on its way for you. And now I would like to introduce you to the Catholic Answers video team that is helping us film the CASA up here. Gentlemen, please share and introduce yourselves to our faithful listeners. First up.
Hi, my name is Andrew. I'm the video producer at Catholic Answers.
My name is Brandon. I am a video editor at Catholic Answers.
And my name is Zach. I'm a video editor as well.
And I'm John Versillo. I'm the director of video at Catholic Answers.
All right, John, let's start with you. So where did the idea for the CASA come from, and what are you hoping to do with the School of Apologetics?
Yeah, well, CASA has been an idea, or the School of Apologetics has been an idea for the apostolate for many years. I've been with Catholic Answers for 20 years. I just celebrated my 20th anniversary of the company actually just last week.
Do you have to get them something gold? Or what's a 20?
Yeah, I have to get the apostolate something gold. They don't give me anything gold. I have to give to them. That's the way ministry works.
Right.
No, we'll see. I don't think I'm going to get anything except get to go to work on Monday. But no, with the School of Apologetics, it's something Carl Keating, our founder, had talked about when I first started all those years ago. And it was something that would always come up because there's really no systematic way for someone to become an apologist. Even our apologist, Trent, you could speak to this. The apologist at Catholic Answers didn't really go to.
Oh yeah, no, I do not have a master's degree in apologetics. What's interesting is that there are Protestant schools that offer, even here in California. Biola is a evangelical school. It used to be called the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. Now it's just called Biola University. They have master's degrees in Christian apologetics. You can get a doctorate in apologetics in certain Protestant schools. But at Catholic schools, at best, they just have master's in theology. So I got a master's in theology, but most of my apologetics, same for me, Jimmy, Carlo, Tim, most of us learned apologetics just through independent study. So I'm super excited with the school. We can condense what we learned in independent study in easy courses. And I think most of the course is going to be what, like 6, 8, 10 hours long?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what everyone's gearing towards doing. And, the nice thing about the CASA also is we're filming. It's all going to be video-based with some written curriculum. but it's going to be short videos. And, you know, being the video department and being involved with video for a number of years now, I think we can all agree, you know, people have such limited bandwidth where everyone's doing so much more now. Everyone has so many more, much more time demands on their time.
Right.
That it's, you know, a good way to learn is through video and specifically short videos. And that's the way this course is going to be, these courses are going to be structured is, yeah, they may be 6 to 10 hours in total length each course, but they'll be broken down into short segments that somebody can get into, spend a half an hour to an hour watching, learning, but they don't have to commit to long periods right. of time. They can jump in and out of it and learn at their pace.
And that's what we have been doing today with my courses. They've on average been between 6 to 10 minutes. Each lesson is only 6 to 10 minutes long. And I think that's important because most people, I remember when I was in youth ministry, we would do teaching segments for teenagers, and we were told to keep it to 7 minutes because teenagers at that time were primed to only pay attention in 7 minute intervals because that's how long TV shows were. You would watch a TV show for 7 minutes and it's a commercial break. But now with YouTube, I think it's cut down from 7 minutes to like 7 seconds for a lot of people. So, but I think the structure of the school lends itself well to that with these short mini lessons. Brandon, I want to get your take a little bit here because it's not just going to be audio, what I'm excited about. I'm going to share some of the audio here with you later in the episode of what we shot today. But it's going to be more than just listening. We've got other dynamic video elements that we're going to put in both in post-production. Maybe you other guys can talk about what we're doing in production right here at the studio.
Mm-hmm. So within our production, I mean, we're shooting on 3 different cameras. So we're going to just try and keep the course like going. So it's going to be very visual. I've created a bunch of different types of graphics. So any kind of keywords or any kind of quotes and Bible verses or quotes from the catechism, they'll all be on the screen and they'll come up in a dynamic way. So it's more than just sitting down and watching somebody speak. It's a full dynamic course that will stimulate your brain in a way that's just more than just, yeah.
And I'm excited to share with you guys where we're filming here. So we're up here in Oceanside. We rented out a studio to do this. And it's a pretty it's not just a black backdrop. I feel like I'm in a cozy Catholic bookworms library or some kind of, this is like a fancy waiting room of a Catholic university is sort of, if I could describe the set. I'll post some pictures at trenhornpodcast.com, but I'm liking it. So maybe you guys can share a little bit about producing the set and what are some things that go into shooting stuff here that most, you know, creating these, this kind of video content that a lot of people just, they don't think about. They don't think that, you have to put this element into it.
Yeah, so, I mean, we can all talk about the set a little bit because it's been a long process of getting it built, and it's just it looks like an actual, like, place that you're in, but in reality, it's just like a half-sea built, like, faux library, and it turns out really cool, and it looks awesome on the camera, so... But yeah, like it takes a long time to build, like at least a full day and a half to set up, because every time we come back here, we have to build up the walls, put it back together, and light it, and it's just like all of the little details that take the longest. So like getting up and making sure everything is lit correctly, and blocking off certain amounts of light, and just changing things just throughout the day. Just to make it, to dial it in and make it look
great. Yeah, we didn't just put a camcorder on a tripod. Like, there's so many elements here. Maybe you guys can speak to that. Some of the elements people don't think about that go to make this happen. Like, even before you hit record on the camera.
Yeah, maybe not before, but after. I think the element that I didn't think of until we started was the storage, not just the space, because we are recording on a bunch of cameras. But kind of the management and how to get it from point A to B and make sure nothing corrupts, make sure we don't lose anything. Because there's a lot of writing on this.
You've been backing up, backing up everything we shoot today.
So we record on an external monitor and then we record inside the camera too. So that's two versions of what we're recording. Then we back both of those up on two separate hard drives. So essentially we have four different usable files for each take. for video, and they're on two separate drives, and then we store them in different locations just in case something catastrophic happens in the location, or one drive dies, which happens all the time. But just the organization is crazy for it, because you're trying to remember which drive we last recorded on, which drive is which, what take was which, and I think we are getting it down.
You guys have put more care into the footage of this school of apologetics than I think I do with my own children. You're like, we have four backups, two locations. If terrorists get one hard drive, the other hard drive is in a bunker. And I put the kids in the car. I'm like, the car seat's a little loose. I'm sure they're fine. And you're like, we have five backups for this. But no, it shows you put all this work. You don't want to put all this work into it and then just, you know, somebody like, oh, I goofed and it disappeared, or I entered the wrong code and I deleted Toy Story 2, which really did happen, by the way.
Yeah.
They like deleted half of Toy Story, and thankfully it's one of the animators saved a backup on their home computer. Otherwise, we wouldn't have that. I'll save that story for another Free For All Friday. But Andrew, maybe you can talk about some other elements. I know you were spending a long time with me in makeup. The diva like me had to get all his makeup on just right.
Yes, it's the most glamorous aspect of the job, getting to put makeup on Trent Horn. But yeah, I mean, that just, you know, amongst the list of things we already talked about, that's, you know, we're really trying to make this look aesthetically pleasing as possible. And part of that is, you know, as, you know, watching, you know, 8 hours of Trent Horn, you know, Trent Horn has to look, you know, at least good enough to where you're and not all distracting.
We can't be too distracting.
Yeah.
Can't be too little of the makeup's got to be just right.
And so
all the while you put on the makeup, I'm just sitting there, Diet Coke. Yeah. Where's my Diet Coke?
Yeah. Trent just turns into, you know, an A-list Hollywood celebrity once the powder comes on. But
I haven't done that yet because they don't have a star over my door. Once I have a star, then it'll be too late.
Maybe for the second course. But yeah, that's just, again, we're trying to, you know, take care of every element, and that, you know, from makeup all the way to, as we talked about earlier, the set. I mean, you know, just going from like blueprints and, you know, working with a production designer, you know, and every step of the way, just making sure, you know, through construction. I mean, we were lucky enough to have it built at Catholic Answers, so we were able to, you know, see it come to fruition and be able to, you know, make adjustments along the way. So every detail was really well thought out. And, you know, we filmed Jimmy's course first, and being able to do one course, getting one course into it, you know, the second time around, we were able to build the set a little faster, you know, learn some lessons from the first time around, and really dial it in. And I think we're, you know, this time around, it's been really a comfortable shoot, and everything is going well, you know, just minor hiccups here and there, but that's, you know, that always happens. As long as nothing major comes up, that helps.
That's my fault. Suddenly I'll be going, and then suddenly I just blank out. But that's why I'm glad we've got the clapboard to do multiple takes, which John Frasilla has been operating. So, John, close us out, because Jimmy's course was first. Jimmy Akin had an intro to apologetics. My course is moral apologetics, how to defend the church's teachings on morality. We're kind of creating our own cinematic universe of these courses, right? It's going to be a kind of a big grand thing. What's the end game here?
Well, I think the end game is the next two courses after yours we'll film Carla Broussard. He'll be doing Evidence for God, so he'll be exploring the five proofs for the evidence of God and many other aspects. And then we'll film Tim Staples, and he's going to do Evidence for the Church. Kind of that's his Tim's sweet spot. So definitely. It's been an exciting project, and
we'll have more, like even more courses.
Right.
After
So in the future, those are our first four core course curriculums. But then in the future, we'll be reaching out to other theologians, other apologists, not just in-house at Catholic Answers, and we'll be doing. We plan to film courses on a number of different topics. You know, church history, patristics, more theology,
Bible, biblical languages,
working with people of other faiths and how we can bring them to the Catholic Church. You know, dealing with Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormonism, just kind of a large gamut of things that we want to do. And one thing I wanted to touch on, you know, to let the listeners know, because they're probably wondering, okay, great, you guys are the film crew, you're filming, but where can I see these?
Right.
And you know, this has been an apostolate-wide effort. I mean, while we're creating the set and we're coming up here to Vista and building the set and filming the courses, we've got marketing and IT and development back at the office, and they all have specific responsibilities. So, in order to see the courses, IT's been working on
creating
online platform that's really sophisticated. That we've found a platform that works really well. It's designed exactly for video learning courses, and so you'll be able to go to this website, sign up, pay for the courses, and it's just very. It's very intuitive, very easy. You'll be able to pick the courses you want to watch. All the lessons will be right there.
And we're going to have lesson notes, downloadable workbooks. It's going to be like it's going to be a real school. And eventually people might even get credit for taking these classes.
Absolutely, yeah. And the other cool thing is you can watch these videos. You won't have to just be at home on the TV. You know, we're in the mobile times now, and so you'll be able to watch it on your iPad, your phone. So yeah, it's a big deal. So I think, you know, definitely listeners should, you know, keep an eye on Catholic.com and your podcast, and for, you know, more information, they'll be seeing and it.
I will
hear about it soon.
And I will let them know when it comes out. And also I'll have the opportunity, I'll do moral apologetics, but in the future I might do other courses as well. So if you want to leave a suggestion at TrendhornPodcast.com underneath this episode, if there's a single topic you would love for me to handle in a course, like an elective, let me know, and let's see, maybe we can get a little voting going on in the comments to see what other courses you would want me to teach to offer as kind of extra bonus elective. So guys, thank you so much for sharing with us today. I'm appreciative of that. And everyone, here is a sneak peek. Here are a few lessons that we filmed today at the School of Apologetics. I hope you enjoy them. Let's roll that clip.
Lesson 18, Magisterial Teaching on Sexual Ethics. I always find it funny that on the one hand people say, the Catholic Church teaches that sex is bad. On the other hand, they say, the Catholic Church wants everybody to have 12 kids. Well, which is it? Is sex bad? Or do they want people to have sex enough that they have 12 children? See, that results in a misunderstanding of what the Church teaches about sexuality. Rather, what the Church teaches is not that sex is a bad thing that we put up with. It teaches that it's a good thing. The Catechism says, the mutual love that exists between man and woman becomes an image of the absolute and unfailing love with which God loves man. It is good, very good, in the Creator's eyes. But here's the problem I alluded to in our previous lecture. Sex has been disordered. It's been marred by concupiscence, which is a desire of the lower appetites or lower passions that are contrary to reason. It's the reason why we feel ashamed when we're naked. We know other people look upon us as objects of lust because of our fallen human nature. And that's why sex presents so much trouble for people. The Catechism says, human nature has not been totally corrupted. It is wounded in the natural powers proper to it, subject to ignorance, suffering, and the dominion of death, and inclined to sin, an inclination to evil that is called concupiscence. Baptism, by imparting the life of Christ's grace, erases original sin and turns a man back towards God. But the consequences for nature, weakened and inclined to evil, persist in man and summon him to spiritual battle. So the lesson to be learned is this. Through Adam, we fell. We have fallen human natures that are inclined to sin. Baptism gives us God's grace. It restores us. It helps us to become children of God, adopted sons and daughters of God. But even baptism cannot change what has happened to our human nature. It cannot undo that struggle with sin all of us endure, especially in the realm of sexuality. And what often happens in the realm of sexuality is that sex becomes disordered, or we engage in these inclinations that are not good for us by missing the essential ends of sex. We don't bother to ask the question, what is sex for? And you can summarize Catholic teaching in a very simple and beautiful way. Sex is ordered towards two ends, procreative and unitive. All sexual acts must have a procreative and unitive element to them. Or even simpler, In order for sex to be moral, it has to have babies and bonding. Babies and bonding. When you take away one or both of these things, sex becomes disordered, sinful, and ultimately harmful for us. Marital love is ordered towards the goods of marriage, and those goods include procreation and the unity of the spouses. Those are the goods of marriage that marital love and the marital act is ordered towards. Let's go through some examples of how sex can become disordered and thus sinful when we lose sight of the babies and the bonding. First, you have cases of babies, but no moral bonding. These would be things like adultery, polyamory, or sexual relations with more than one person at one time, and fornication, which is sexual activity outside of marriage. You can have babies from these behaviors, and you have a bonding that takes place when it's a sexual union between men and women, but it's not a moral bonding because it's not within the bonds of matrimony that unites one man and one woman together in the sacrament of marriage. This is what the Catechism says about fornication. Fornication is carnal union between an unmarried man and an unmarried woman. It is gravely contrary to the dignity of persons and of human sexuality, which is naturally ordered to the good of spouses and the generation and education of children. Moreover, it is a grave scandal when there is corruption of the young. So fornication is wrong because it opens the possibility of babies, and yet you have a mother and father who are not bound together in marriage. They become bound to this child and not bound to one another, which can lead to parents abandoning their children or worse, aborting their children. And it leads to bonding, but not moral bonding because it's outside of the bounds of marriage. Here's another example when sexuality becomes disordered. You have babies, but absolutely no bonding at all. That would be something like in vitro fertilization, where a husband and wife give their genetic material, sperm and egg, to a laboratory technician who creates the child in a petri dish by combining the sperm and egg and then implanting that human embryo in the mother's body. You have babies outside of the bonding that should make children a gift of the marital act. Next, you have bonding, but no babies. This is the opposite of in vitro fertilization, where with in vitro, you get the babies without the bonding. What do you do to get bonding without the babies? Well, that's contraception. Here's what the Catechism says. A child does not come from outside as something added on to the mutual love of the spouses, but springs from the very heart of that mutual giving as its fruit and fulfillment. So the Church, which is on the side of life, teaches that it is necessary that each and every marriage act remain ordered per se to the procreation of human life. That doesn't mean that every couple, married couple who engages in marital intimacy must do so with the explicit goal of having a baby, and if they don't have a baby, they've sinned. That's not what the Church teaches. The Church teaches that every marital act must be open to life, open to babies. You can't do something that purposely shuts the babies out, such as by using a latex barrier or hormonal contraception. So remember the two ends for sex to be ordered properly. It's got to be ordered towards babies, at least the possibility of them, and it has to be bonding, where husband and wife come together in the marital act. So you can have babies without bonding, IVF, bonding without babies, contraception, babies without moral bonding, like fornication, and then there are sexual behaviors where there's no bonding and no babies. So that would be when sexuality becomes most disordered. No bonding between men and women, and no babies are possible. You can see this in things like masturbation or homosexual behavior. So remember, sex is something that is good. And we should tell people, especially young people, that we're teaching about sex when they enter puberty, that it's good, but it becomes bad when we misuse it or use it in a disordered way. And that would include things like homosexuality and masturbation. So remember, it's important to affirm the Church teaches that sex is good. We make it bad when we use it in a disordered way, and that can cause a lot of people harm. According to the Vatican document, The Truth and Meaning of Human Sexuality, it says, parents should not give the false impression that sex is something shameful or dirty, because it is a great gift of God who placed the ability to generate life in the human body, thereby sharing his creative power with us. I mean, that is just amazing. God trusted us to be able to have the ability to engage in an act that brings a new human being with an immortal soul into existence. That in and of itself should show that sex has profound moral gravity to it. And we'll see that any reasonable person can see this, even if they don't believe in biblical sexual ethics, magisterial sexual ethics. We can know from natural law itself that sex should be treated with a proper reverence and should only be used within a proper context. Lesson 19, Scholastic Natural Law. How do you summarize the moral life in 5 words or less? Give it a shot. Well, here's how St. Thomas Aquinas would probably do it. He'd say, do good and avoid evil. Do good and avoid evil. The most basic elements of the moral law. So we're going to talk now about scholastic natural law, that we can use reason to understand how we as human beings ought to live and treat one another. And we can know that by looking at our human nature, by looking at the world around us and asking the question, what is this and what is it for? What is it and what is it for? We can even ask a more basic question. What does it mean for something to be good or bad? In order for that to be intelligible, we have to know what the thing is that we're talking about. Because good or bad refers to something being in conformity with its nature. For example, a good tree is one that's not withered, that bears fruit. A good squirrel is one that climbs up said tree and gathers nuts. A bad tree is withered and doesn't have good fruit. A bad squirrel can't find nuts to save his life, or he can't climb up the tree. And good human acts flow from how human beings ought to act. So when I say that a tree is good, I don't mean that it's morally good, but it's in conformity with its nature. The same for the good squirrel. But human beings are different. Human beings have a moral element to them, which is rooted in our rational nature. We can think about our actions. We're not animals that go from meal to meal. Hopefully we aren't. No, we can think about the future and plan and deliberate and understand, even if we have a strong instinct to do something, we ought not act upon it. It's not in conformity with our true human nature. But to know how human beings should act or how anything should be, we have to ask, well, what is it and what is it for? The philosopher Peter Geech gives a good example. Imagine if I asked you, what makes a good hygrometer? So there's my question for you. What makes a good hygrometer? You might ask the question, what in the world is a hygrometer? Because we can't know if a hygrometer is good unless we know what a hygrometer is for. We can't say, this is a good hygrometer. It's not a hygrometer, it's a computer mouse. So I can't answer the question. I have to know what a hygrometer is and what its purpose is. Then if I know what its purpose is, I know if a hygrometer is a good one. And in case you don't have to look this up, a hygrometer is a tool that's used to measure humidity and water vapor in the air. So a good hygrometer, if it's measuring humidity correctly, hey, it's a good hygrometer. If it's not meeting that task, then it's not good. So then we look at human beings. How should human beings function? What are human beings for? What is the purpose of our lives, especially the purpose of our bodies? Well, just as we look at things in nature and we can see their proper end, be it a tree or a squirrel, or even in things humans create, like a hygrometer, we can say the same thing within our bodies. We see digestive systems are for eating. And when they don't accomplish that goal, or we do something that's directly contrary to that goal, we've done something bad for our digestive system. Our respiratory system is for breathing. When we act contrary to that goal, we do something bad to our respiratory system. And the same is true of our reproductive system. It's very clear it's for reproduction. And when we act contrary to that goal, when we pervert that goal of that bodily system, then we act in a bad way. We act wrongly. So we can use these bodily systems, by the way, even if the end goal is not achieved. So for example, it's okay to eat food even if you're sick and you're unable to absorb the nutrients. Or you can engage in sexual relations even if you're temporarily or permanently infertile. The problem is when we pervert these systems or use them in a way contrary to their proper ends. So if we breathe in poisonous gases, or maybe we eat nails or glass, and some people have a natural desire to do this, or we eat food and then immediately vomit it back up again because we want the taste of food without the digestion that comes with it, here we take the digestive system and use it directly contrary for its purpose in a disordered and thus wrong way. And the same is true for our sexual organs. We use our sexual organs badly when we pervert their natural end. which is reproduction and procreation, which can only take place in the one flesh union between a man and woman. Now, let me look at two objections people might make to this kind of scholastic natural law argument for Catholic sexual morality. First is the harm objection. People will say, look, when you talk about eating nails and glass or breathing gas, those things are wrong because we clearly see the harm. We see the alveoli in the lungs is damaged. The nails shred the intestines. Behaviors are only bad if they cause harm to our bodies. If nobody's harmed, it's not a big deal. One, that does not explain how some sexually disordered behaviors like sodomy can cause grave harm for the human body. But it also doesn't explain non-injurious wrongs related to sexuality. A few examples would be the wrongness of having violent fantasies and dwelling on violent or lustful sexual fantasies in the mind. If harm is the only criteria for wrongness, well, then there's nothing wrong with having these violent fantasies. Or it doesn't explain sexual disorders that can be participated in or engaged in that don't cause severe harm to the body. And these are very unpleasant to talk about, I will warn you. But in our day and age, to show that sexual morality by a secular standard doesn't work, you sometimes have to go to the very boundaries of decent behavior to show people their moral system is in error. I mean, you could engage in things like necrophilia, sexual behavior with the dead, or zoophilia, sexual behavior with animals, in a way that does not cause harm to one's own body, yet that's clearly wrong. But why is it wrong? Because when we look at the human body, we see our sexual organs are not meant for these kinds of behaviors. They're meant for uniting with, at the very minimum, other living human beings. But why should we believe that? You can know that sex with an animal or sex with a dead body is wrong by looking at the design of our body. But if you see the design of our body, we see that other sexual behaviors, especially those that have no babies or no bonding involved, like masturbation or homosexual behavior, are also wrong. Another objection is the unnatural objection. People will say, you scholastic theologians, you care about natural law and things being natural. Well, guess what? Homosexuality occurs in nature, and human beings do all kinds of unnatural things. So where's your argument now? Well, first, non-human animals engage in lots of behaviors that if humans were to engage in them, would be sinful. Yes, non-human animals engage in sexual behavior with other animals of the same sex. They also steal from one another, murder, and engage in forced copulation, which if humans did that, we would call it murder, theft, and rape. So just because non-human animals naturally do these things doesn't mean it's natural for humans to do them. And human beings engage in unnatural behaviors in the sense that we use technology to augment our natural abilities. So yes, we wear eyeglasses, we fly in airplanes, we hold our breath, but none of these things pervert the natural processes of seeing, breathing, or moving about from one place to another. They don't contradict or pervert the natural end of these behaviors. But sexual sin is unnatural because it distorts the natural ends of sexuality, which is unity of the spouses, or bonding, and procreation, or babies. When you lose those two ends, you lose what grounds our sexual morality from descending into sexual insanity.
I want to thank you guys so much for joining us on this episode. I hope you enjoyed that sneak peek of the School of Apologetics, my course, Moral Apologetics, How to Defend the Moral Teachings of Our Church. You guys have been great. Pray for next week. Everything goes well. We can have this great dialogue with John Loftus, the atheist, on whether miracles are something we can believe in. So pray for that. And I hope you guys have a blessed weekend. And I'll see you all later.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.